Hi, everybody. This is your professor, a rookie at Zoom, and I wanted to let you know that I'm glad to have you back from our long spring break. My rookiness with Zoom means that this is the third time that I'm recording this lecture. I recorded it yesterday, but shared the wrong screen so that you could see nothing that I wanted you to see, and a bunch of stuff that you really didn't need to see, like me sitting here in my basement office. So today I'm recording it a third time, and I'm also audio recording it on my phone just in case, for whatever reason, Zoom is not happy with this recording. But let me go through the items that we need to talk about and welcome you back. I'm gonna share my slides with you so that you can see what I'm talking about. These are available on the class website as usual. I have a whole lot of announcements that I wanna give you before we start. And then I'm gonna talk about one chapter from Deadly Justice as the main topic for today. But let me go through the announcements first. And as I do, I'm gonna shift you over to my slides rather than looking at me. All right, this is me again. I wanna welcome you again. And the first announcement is that during class time, so starting at about 11 o'clock today, maybe after you've watched this, or perhaps while you're watching this video, you can join me in my office hours by Zoom, and you can see the URL for that on the first website, on the first slide of the class lecture. And I'll be doing that every Monday and Wednesday during our regular class time. I want you also to be sure to go ahead and review the class website, and I'm going to switch over to that right now. But at the top, you'll see a number of announcements. And then towards week 10 to 15, in the schedule part of the webpage, you'll see a bunch of changes. So let me go through those very quickly, and I'm going to switch over to the class webpage, which is here. So if you look on the first line after the Zoom office hours announcement, there's an announcement, an update from March 17th about changes to your requirements. I had sent that to you already, so you should be familiar with it. The biggest change in the requirements is that we're not going to do the planned group presentations. And that's something that I very much regret, and I'll come back to that later. But I didn't see a way for us to work out the logistics to do that, given the current situation. So I'm really sorry about that, but hopefully it will work out okay. That also means that we've extended a little bit the deadline for your second paper. And I've also asked you to write that paper in a little bit of a longer format, because it will count for a little bit more than it had been scheduled to count for in terms of your final grade. So anyway, read that announcement, that update, carefully. Also here we have a link to information about a resource called Vital Source, which is not a nutritional supplement, but rather a way that you can get electronic access to a lot of your textbooks. So please look at that. And finally, just last week, the Chancellor announced a change in your options for grading, including the opportunity to take this class or any other class as a pass-fail. And I wanted to recommend that you do that. Whether you want to or not, I think there's going to be difficulties in assessing your performance very accurately. And, you know, I'm not happy with that by any means, but I do think that we'll all be better off if the large majority, if not all of you, elect to take this class on a pass-fail basis. It's not a requirement, but I would encourage it strongly. If you go down to the part of the schedule for the class, you'll see that I'm going to be making a number of changes. So please continue to review that and go back to this page as often as you need to, as usual. Okay. All right. So let me also mention that, you know, I very much hope that all of you are well, that your loved ones are well. I understand that this is a ridiculous and difficult time for all of us. I personally am fine. I'm at home, but I'll be missing the opportunity to teach in person. Teaching remotely is definitely a second best option. It's probably better than nothing. I think it is definitely better than nothing, but it's not the real thing. And so I'm going to try to mitigate the damage, do my best. I want you to do your best. But I do feel like I'm hiding away in my basement playing some kind of whatever those games are, World of Warcraft, or I don't even know the rest of the names of them. But I'm not doing that, I promise. I'm actually trying to get some research done and then recording these lectures and being available for my other responsibilities. So we just are going to have to make the best of all of this. I wanted to let you know also that, you know, one of the biggest reasons why I think this class has 400 students is the evening speaker series. And I very much regret that I've had to cancel those. And the other thing that I wanted to mention about that is that I have given some thought about the possibility of holding remote speakers events, but decided against it for a number of reasons. But the main one is that I don't really have confidence that the logistics would work with our particular speakers. And so I'm not planning on scheduling any of these events as Zoom lectures or anything like that. I did think about it. Some of you have suggested that to me, and I appreciate the suggestion, but I just don't see how I can make it work logistically. The other thing I wanted to mention about the speakers is to ask you whether you think it would be of interest for me to try to schedule some of those speakers next fall or anytime next academic year when things come back to normal. Obviously, that would be outside of the context of this class, but I could certainly look into that. So I would appreciate your feedback on that issue. Now, I wanted to mention a number of other things. As I mentioned before, this is going to be second best. Listening to a recorded lecture is not the same as attending class. Your university experience for the rest of the semester is going to be compromised. I understand that. But we have to make the best of it. So one is, for me, I'm going to be as flexible as possible. And also, you know, this is my first rodeo, and I would appreciate any suggestions that any of you have for how to make this experience better. And I would be open to listening to any of your ideas. I'll be doing my best. I'll try to be as flexible as possible, and I'll try to give you some extra resources through these recorded lectures. What can you do? I think, you know, every college course has this truism. That is that the student who puts the most in gets the most out. And so you can put some things into this class. Do the readings. You have plenty of time to do the readings. You can email me with questions, and I'll have these Zoom office hours. You can continue to participate in your recitation sections with your teaching assistants. I'll be meeting with them regularly, at least every week, through a Zoom meeting. And then, as you may recall, on the Deadly Justice book webpage, there's a number of links, and I want to show you some of these, and actually I'm going to require that you participate in some of these or get involved in these. If you go to my webpage, click on books, click on Deadly Justice, click on links, you'll see dozens of opportunities and links to movies, TV shows, documentaries, podcasts, and other items associated with the death penalty that I've put together over the years, or I put it together with the help of some students immediately after we published that book. And I would like to encourage you to go to that webpage and then use some of the links that are available there. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to require that you do so. The reason for that is the following. The university canceled, obviously, two of our lectures and your recitation sections last week in the decision to extend spring break and keep people away from campus for as long as possible. And also, in this particular class, which, as you recall, is 4 credit hours rather than 3, we've also canceled 4 speakers events. It turns out that the university policies require that we make up that time. So the solution to that is that I'm going to be recording 3 lectures most weeks from now on, rather than just 2. Some of them may not be the full length, but they'll be on focused topics. And so we'll make up some of the lost time through extra lectures that you'll need to pay attention to, and which will be part of the final exam and all that. But also, I'm going to require that each of you watch or listen to 2 movies or spend 4 to 6 hours on the information available at the links page of the Deadly Justice website. Now, this is on your honor, but it should be interesting and hopefully enjoyable and informative. Those are important things to know. So if you haven't already done so, please go to those links and pay attention to a couple of them. Spend an afternoon, spend a couple of afternoons, spend some evenings exploring the popular media and documentaries about this topic. There's a lot there. Now, that material, each of you will do something different. So therefore, I'm not going to evaluate your performance with regards to that, but it is a requirement of the class, nonetheless. Last couple announcements. I mentioned first that the second paper needs to be a little bit longer than it would have been than it was designed to be in the original syllabus, because we're canceling the group presentations. The group presentations had been scheduled to count for 10% of your grade. The second paper was supposed to count for 20%. So I would like your second paper then to be a little bit longer, about half again as long. So it was supposed to be 5 pages. Now it needs to be about 7.5 pages, roughly speaking, and that will count for 30% of your grade. Okay. You can correspond with your teaching assistants about this. I know that they're working to give you a little bit different assignments, prompts, so that you can extend your analysis of those very interesting books. Also, I have gotten from a few of you some emails asking me to address certain particular questions. I would love to get more of those from you. Those questions might be things that we've covered that you don't understand, things that we have not covered that you think would be of interest, or any other questions about criminal justice or my own research or the university or whatever you think might be of interest to other students and yourselves. Here's an example of some questions that I got from one of you. Why were there no executions in North Carolina in the early years of the 1980s? In the late 1970s, what about the federal death penalty? How does the U.S. compare to other countries in its use of capital punishment? We haven't talked much about that. What about the military death penalty? How does that work? And so forth. The student also asked one particular question just to me personally. What did I learn that's the most interesting? So I'll be addressing those questions in a future lecture, or maybe in more than one lecture. But I would love to get more, so email me or contact me through my office hours on Zoom, and I would love to get more feedback from you about topics that you would like to like for me to address. And then, as I mentioned, the chancellor has given you the opportunity to take this class on a pass-fail basis. I would encourage you to do that, okay? Also, if you have other suggestions for the administration of the class, feel free to be in touch. I will be as flexible as possible. As you may recall, the class requires a number of quizzes, and so far you haven't had any quizzes. So I'm going to start to give you some quizzes to make sure that everybody is up to date with the material. We'll be completing our discussion of Deadly Justice. And as you know, that book was designed to be the outline of this very class. It's specifically designed to it. That's why we've spent so much time going through this book. And I'll be giving you some quizzes about the chapters, the material covered. And I'll go in chronological, in order of the book, of the chapters of the book. So the first quizzes, the first quiz will be this week, and it'll be due on Friday, and you'll have a quiz that's due every Friday. And I should have them available to you on Sakai every Wednesday afternoon, and then it'll be a requirement that you complete the work by the end of the day, midnight on Friday evening. Okay, you're on your honor to do that work on your own, of course. Now, one thing that often comes up when a professor mentions the concept of a quiz or a test is, do I have to know facts? And the answer is yes. This is a class about facts and figures more than it's a class about opinions and judgments. I've specifically designed it that way because the death penalty is a topic where many of us can have our opinions, judgments, moral values, but it is also a government program and we need to understand how it really works. So to the question, do I need to know the names of the Supreme Court decisions? The answer is yes. Do I need to know the constitutional questions related to due process or to probable cause or to unreasonable search and seizure, equal protection, cruel and unusual punishment? The answer is yes. You need to know those things. And you remember the quiz that I gave you, the ungraded quiz that I gave you on the first day of class, asked questions like, how many people live in the United States? And I would review those questions as well. You should know, roughly speaking, within, you know, a few dozen percent. You don't have to know precisely, but you should know that that North Carolina has somewhere in the order of 500 or 600 homicides every year. Not 5,000 or 6,000 and not 50,000, but 500, roughly speaking. That we've got a few dozen death sentences and a few dozen executions nationally these days, whereas in the late 1990s, we had maybe 300 or so death sentences and as many as 98 executions in a single year. We've never had thousands of executions in a single year, even back in previous historical periods. You should know those orders of magnitudes, okay? I've put on this slide a link to the National Archives where you can read the Bill of Rights. I would encourage you to read it, understand it, and keep it in your brain. Next time you get stopped by a police officer, you should know the Fourth Amendment. You have the freedom to be not to be subjected to an unreasonable search, and you should understand all of your rights, especially if you're a political science major. This is something that you should pretty much memorize if you haven't already done so. But anyway, in answer to the question, do I need to know facts and figures to do well on the quizzes in Poly 203? The answer is yes. Okay. I also wanted to reiterate how sorry I am to cancel the group presentations. I had spent a lot of time thinking about how to get you familiar with a number of interesting books that trace the cases of particular people like Carlos de Luna or the different books that are described, the cases that are described in the books that I've assigned to you, each in your separate sections. And so I'm really sorry that we're not going to be able to share that information with the entire lecture class. I couldn't figure out a way to make that happen. Okay. But if there are particular elements of the book that you read that you feel really need to be shared, email me and tell me about it. Just let me know what you think is so important about that book that needs to be brought to the attention of all the other students. And if you know other students, share your books, read their book. Share your book with the other ones if you found it to be interesting. Or engage in some discussion about that across your sections if you know students in other sections. So anyway, I'm really sorry that we can't do those class presentations, but that's where we are. Okay, that's really all I have about the announcements and transitions. I'm going to shift on the next slide to start talking about the subject matter of our class again. That's the decline of the death penalty described in Chapter 16 of Deadly Justice. But let me just reiterate that I want you to understand that we'll be as flexible as we need to be, as flexible as we can be with regards to your assignments, your participation. Please feel free to email me with your suggestions about anything related to this course. Stay in touch with your TAs and make sure you participate in your recitations. They'll be doing those through Zoom. And then certainly be in touch with me if you have connectivity problems or issues with logistics of participating in class or seeing these lectures. Okay, so we're going to talk now about chapter 16 of our book, Is the Death Penalty Disappearing, Going Away, Dying a Slow Death, Just Dwindling Down to Nothing. There is no question that trends are all in the direction of down, down, and down for the last 20 to 25 years. It's been going down. And then the constitutionally relevant question there becomes, have we reached a point where evolving standards of decency mean that the death penalty is no longer in compliance with the cruel and unusual phrase of the Eighth Amendment? Okay, so this concept of evolving standards of decency is really important idea, so we're going to talk about that. Could there ever be a point when the death penalty is so rare, or where it's carried out only in so few jurisdictions, or even in one or two states, that the Supreme Court would declare that it's no longer part of the moral fabric of the United States, and therefore does not comport with evolving standards of decency? Okay, that's a big question. One where the answer is not clear, and so we need to talk about it. So let me give you a little bit of data. On the left-hand side on this slide, you can see that the modern period of the death penalty involved a very quick resurgence of the use of death sentencing. Immediately from 1972, by 1974, there were hundreds of death sentences. 250 death sentences in 1974. A slight decline as there was uncertainty about whether these laws would be constitutional. And so in 1976, of course, some of them, including the law in North Carolina that was very proactive in its use of the death penalty because it made it mandatory for first degree murder, was ruled unconstitutional. And so there was a setback in this kind of very quick acceleration in the use of the death penalty in 1976, but then it came back, and in the 1980s and 90s, it was back with about as many as, roughly speaking, 300 death sentences per year during that period in the 1980s and 90s. Now, I want to put that number 300 in context, because 300 death sentences should be compared to the number of homicides that were taking place in those years. And those numbers, as you might recall from the first day of class or the first couple weeks of this class, in the 1980s and 90s, those numbers were in the 20,000s. So if we had 20,000 homicides and 300 death sentences, was that constitutionally unusual? Was that so rare, even at the peak usage of the death penalty, that it would still fall into question under the Furman rule about whether it was so rare, even for those guilty of a heinous crime, such as homicide, and so that they would be unusual in the sense that being struck by lightning is unusual? That's an open question to me, even at the peak usage with about 300 or even more than 300 death sentences per year. But as you can also see during the 1990s, 2000s, 2010s on to present, the number of death sentences has declined precipitously, as has the number of executions. Now, the number of executions, the red line in that figure, grew more slowly because, of course, it takes a long time to move from a death sentence to an execution. But it definitely ramped up very, very quickly in the 1990s, so that by 1998, there were 98 executions in the United States. And today, we would have on the order of 20 to 25. Okay, so it's declined by 3/4. Death sentences have declined by even more than that proportionately. So there's only a handful or a few dozen death sentences, and then about 24 executions being carried out in recent years. But if you look at the right-hand side of this graph or this slide that I'm displaying, you can also see that if we look at a longer historical trend in the 1900s up until 1970, before the modern period of the death penalty, there was a huge decline in use of the death penalty in the United States from 1935, when it reached its peak, until the mid-1960s, when the number of executions went down to zero. And in fact, there were no executions at all between 1966 and 1977, when the first modern execution took place. So if the death penalty was not declared unconstitutional because it was cruel and unusual in 1972, but merely the existing laws were declared to be cruel and unusual, like being struck by lightning because they were so unusual, but that new revised laws would be okay, that suggests at least one option is that the evolving standards of decency would not imply that there should be no death sentences, even though today it's declining. So that's an interesting question to think about. What would be the implication if the number of death sentences declined to be 3 per year, or the number of executions declined to be 0 for some number of years going into the future? Would that create a constitutional crisis for the death penalty? Well, that's one element of the consideration of evolving standards of decency, and it's worth you thinking about. Another element is how many jurisdictions retain the option or the legal authority to carry out an execution. And so in the slide that you're looking at now, you can see that in the 1960s, there were 47 jurisdictions in the United States that allowed for the legal opportunity to carry out an execution or to sentence someone to death. That's 47 out of 53. The 53 would be the 50 states, the District of Columbia, the U.S. military, and the federal government. By 1972, that number had gone down to 44. And then in Furman, of course, all those laws were invalidated. Florida came back already before the end of 1972 to reinstitute its death penalty, so that at the end of 1972, there was one state with a valid death penalty law. That was Florida. By 1974, 75, 76, most states had come back with their revised laws, and that number settled down to about 40 in the late 1990s, where it stayed stable for quite some time. Since 2006, a number of states have abolished, and no states have reestablished those numbers, so that at this point, at the end of 2019, we ended up with 31 jurisdictions rather than 47 two generations ago. The states that have abolished are listed on this slide, and you can notice that for the most part, they're northern and western states: New Jersey, New York, New Mexico, which would be a counterexample, Illinois, Connecticut, Maryland, Delaware, Washington State, and New Hampshire have all abolished. Every one of those states, except for New York, abolished through a vote of its legislature. And that's an important distinction. It's the only time in American history when regular votes in legislatures have been the cause of the abolition of the death penalty. in modern American history, I should say. In New York, the state Supreme Court ruled that the function of the death penalty in that state was incompatible with the state constitution. And then the legislature never wrote a new law. So the existing law was ruled unconstitutional, and then they simply let it die. But they never took a vote to kill it. In New Jersey, and in all the other states indicated, elected officials actually took a vote to kill the death penalty. So that's a very politically different situation than the one in New York State. Now, there are four states that have a moratorium at the moment: Oregon, Colorado, Pennsylvania, and California. Those moratoria apply to executions, not to death sentences. So you could still potentially be sentenced to death in California or Pennsylvania today, but the governors have declared in both states that there will be no executions on their watch. So there is pretty significant evidence that there are trends towards abolishing and no counter trends towards reestablishing the death penalty. I should mention one detail about this. The state of Nebraska voted to abolish the death penalty in 2015, but the governor, who was opposed to it, immediately started a referendum campaign to reestablish the death penalty before it even was rescinded. That is, the law was passed over his veto to abolish, and then immediately there was a referendum that established the death penalty again before the effective date of that legislation in 2015. So Nebraska is a bit of a counterexample to the idea that all the trends have gone in one direction. I should mention also that California had a referendum to abolish the death penalty, and the referendum failed. That was, I can't remember the exact date, 2015, 2016, 2012, somewhere in there. And it failed by a vote of 52-48, which was a relatively close vote. In 1976 or 78, when California established the death penalty by referendum, it passed by something like 70-30. So coming that close to abolishing in a popular referendum could be seen either as a sign of continued support for the death penalty or for its demise. But anyway, it did not pass, and California retains its huge death penalty system. Another indicator about evolving standards of decency has to do with whether states are considering legislation to restrict or abolish the death penalty, or whether they're considering legislation that would expand the use of the death penalty or reestablish it if it's been abolished. And so I had a student, Alex Loyal, look at state legislative bills over the period from 1980 to 2012, I think. And we have not updated this yet, but it would be interesting to update this graph. And you can see that until about 1996, most of the laws or bills that were considered in the state legislatures were in the direction of expanding the use of the death penalty. That is, making more crimes eligible for death or restricting the rights of inmates who have been convicted to appeal, or restricting their right to highly trained attorneys or something like that. And then in a dramatic shift in the late 1990s, states moved towards the opposite direction. Most of the laws that are being considered or bills that are being considered within state legislatures in the more recent period have to do with expanding the rights of appeal, expanding the resources available to capital defense attorneys, restricting the number of crimes eligible for the death penalty, abolishing the death penalty overall or outright, and so forth. So the direction of legislative action is definitely in the direction of abolition or restriction these days. That was not true in the 1980s. So if we look at the statistical trends of, for example, how many executions occur, how many death sentences occur, how many states are carrying out executions or death sentences, or how many counties are responsible for it, those cases, you can see that all the trends went up, up, up from the 1970s until about the mid to late 1990s. And then in the new century, all the trends have been dramatically downwards. And so if we just look from the period from 1995 to present, you can see these trends are quite dramatic. And they mean that the share from the historic peak in the late 1990s or mid 1990s, depending, the share that we see today from those peaks is, you know, 20%, 30%, 40% of what we saw in the earlier period. So there is really no question about the direction of legislative action, the direction of actual use. The number of states with a legally available death penalty is lower today than it was 20 years ago. And so now the question is, does that does that generate a constitutional issue based on evolving standards of decency? So let's talk about that concept for a second. Evolving standards of decency has been a very controversial aspect of constitutional jurisprudence in the Supreme Court. In 1910, in a case that had nothing to do with the death penalty, the court ruled that the Eighth Amendment is not fastened to an absolute. Remember, the Eighth Amendment deals with cruel and unusual punishments. And the question could be, what's cruel? Okay, in medieval times, certain things might not have been considered to be cruel. And what was considered to be cruel in 1789 when the Constitution was written might not be the same today, according to this concept of evolving standards. So anyway, they came up with that the first time in 1910, saying that the Eighth Amendment is not fastened to an absolute, but may acquire meaning as public opinion becomes enlightened by humane justice. And similarly, in 1958, for the first time, the court used this concept or the phrase of evolving standards of decency. And it said that the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual, draws its meaning from the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. So in both the Weems and the Trop v. Dulles decisions, the court is doing two things. It's interesting to think about. Saying that it can change, but also saying that we Americans today have a higher civilization than that of our ancestors, that we're moving in a direction of higher justice, more humane justice, or a maturing society. I think that's an open question, but it certainly is one that the justices believed. At least the majority voting justices in 1910 and 1958. Okay, so that's the concept of evolving standards. It's a very controversial concept. There's two cases, Atkins v. Virginia and Roper v. Simmons, where these decisions about evolving standards meant that the court reversed itself and reversed hundreds of years of precedent to declare the death penalty incompatible with the Constitution in two particular categories. In Atkins v. Virginia, it was for people with intellectual disabilities, and in Roper v. Simmons, it was for people who were under the age of 18 at the time of the crime. So let's look at those two cases in particular. The Atkins decision said that you can't execute or you can't carry out a death, you can't sentence someone to death if they have an intellectual disability. An intellectual disability means, roughly speaking, that you have an IQ less than 70. But in 1989, the court had considered exactly this very same question in another case, the Penry case. And they had said that it is okay to do as we've always done, to carry out death sentences with regards to people who have intellectual disabilities. So that was 1989. In 2002, they said the exact opposite. They said that you can't do it. So what had changed? And I want you to note that that was just a 13-year period that moved us from the 1989 decision to the 2002 decision. In Roper v. Simmons, we have something very, very similar. Roper v. Simmons says you can't execute somebody who was 17 years old or younger at the time of the crime. They have to be at least 18 years old. And I want to show you something from the DPIC website, and I'll move to that in just a second. But it's worth noting that in 1988, Thompson v. Oklahoma said that you can't execute people who are under the age of 16. And you can imagine that when they argued that case in 1988, people debated about what's the cutoff. Should it be 16, 14, 18, 21, 25? What should be the cutoff? And they came up with a cutoff of 16. And in 1989, they validated that cutoff, saying that in response to the obvious next appeal, yes, it is okay to execute people who are over 16 years old. So that's 1989, saying it's okay to execute someone who's a child, because legally speaking, you're a child when you're 17 years old and you're an adult when you're 18. So anyway, they said that in 1989, and then by 2005, they changed dramatically and 180 degrees. They changed. Let me show you something from DPIC. Executions database. You can see that the database has 1,500 executions listed. And I'm going to click on a filter, juvenile, apply that search criteria, and you can see that from the DPIC database available online, there's 22 executions of people who were juveniles at the time of the crime. And the one thing I want to bring your attention to is the dates of these executions: 1998, 99, 2000, 2001, up to 2003. Okay. And in fact, 13 of the executions of those 22 individuals, 13 of those come in that period from 1998 to 2003. And then just 2 years later, 2005, the court rules that it's unconstitutional to execute people who are under the age of 18. So that's a quite a shocking reversal. So I would suggest that you reread the pages indicated there from the book, and I want to now talk about the concept of evolving standards and what are the indicators that the court might use. So many different indicators, what the court calls indicia, were cited by the court. One has to do with how many states allow that particular punishment, and they're not really counting up how many states or how many jurisdictions. They're counting the trend: how many have abolished the practice, how many have reduced it, versus how many have expanded it. And the idea is that evolving standards can be indicated by trends in legislative activity. Also, it can be noted by trends in the frequency of use, okay, or the direction of legislative action. They also mention scientific research. That could be social scientific research. It could be psychological, cognitive science about the nature of the adolescent brain. It could be a number of things. The courts also mention international trends, whether our countries such as England, which is always pointed to because our legal system derived from theirs, or other countries have adopted or abandoned the practice. This was particularly frustrating to some of the justices to see that. But the majority justices cited international trends. And then finally, and this is the most controversial, the court indicated that it has sometimes to substitute or to use its quote-unquote own judgment. And so those are the different indicators that they use. This led to very, very hostile, frustrated, angry responses from the justices who were in the minority in the Atkins and Roper v. Simmons decisions. So we'll talk about that in the next couple slides, but I want you to pay attention to what the majority justices indicated, because that sets precedence And also, the concept of original intent implies that none of this should matter at all, whatsoever. If you are an originalist, you believe that the Constitution was written by the Founding Fathers, it still means what it meant then. It does not change. And so that's a very important constitutional question. The idea of original intent suggests that evolving standards of decency should be completely irrelevant, and the constitutional meaning was set in 1789, and that's the end of the question. So when you hear debates about who should be nominated or confirmed for the U.S. Supreme Court, and there's these very esoteric issues about originalism or original intent and the potential for evolving standards of meaning of the words in the Constitution, those aren't code words. Those are really powerful indicators about where that justice stands on certain important questions, okay, in particular with regards to the death penalty. Now, in Roper v. Simmons, the justices confronted these issues very clearly. And in a concurring opinion, Justices Stevens and Ginsburg wrote that the question of evolving standards is fundamental. And it says that if the meaning of the Eighth Amendment had been frozen when it was originally drafted, it would impose no impediment to the execution of seven-year-old children even today. And they cite Stanford v. Kennedy, or Kentucky, which was a 1989 decision that ruled that it is okay to execute people who are 16 and 17 years old. So in reversing that decision, the Stanford decision, these justices are bringing attention to the idea that the original intent camp of the Supreme Court would have some radical ideas, okay? Of course, the Constitution makes reference to severance of limbs, the loss of limb, the loss of life, the loss of liberty. And so it is clear that the originalists envisioned cutting off hands, cutting off legs, feet, things like that. And so these justices are bringing that starkly to our attention in their decision. This led to some really strong counter reactions. Justice O'Connor agreed on the case of Atkins, but dissented from some aspects of it. She thought that there might be some 17-year-olds who deserve the death penalty for particularly heinous crimes. But Justice Scalia wrote a scathing and long review that I would encourage you to read. And he raised a whole number of issues. And I brought these issues to the fore here. And I also just wanted to show you that if you go to this website that I've linked to, you can read the opinion, the majority opinion, the concurring opinion by Justices Stevens and Ginsburg, the dissent from Justice O'Connor, and then this long dissent from Justice Scalia, which is joined by Justice Thomas and by the Chief Justice, Justice Rehnquist. So I would encourage you to read those, okay? And you'll see that Justice Scalia raised a number of issues, and this is kind of like a roadmap for a critique of the entire concept of evolving standards of decency, because Justice Scalia does not believe in it. Or did not believe in it. So what can we say altogether about this issue of evolving standards? First of all, it's important to recognize that Roper and Atkins are the law of the land. Evolving standards was an important part of the decision-making of the court, of the majority of the court in Roper and in Atkins. And we no longer execute juveniles, whereas we used to. So that's an important change in our constitutional structure. We also no longer execute people with intellectual disabilities, or at least we're not supposed to, according to the court. So those are big changes, and they do move us in the direction of what the court previously called a more humane justice. Okay. So evolving standards of decency is the law of the land, okay? But it's a controversial aspect, And this is why appointments to the Supreme Court are so important, because people can disagree about this. And if they disagree about original intent, if they find the original intent to be a driving force, they would simply reject all arguments about evolving standards. Okay. And at the end of the day, there is no guidance. We don't know for sure how these decisions would be evaluated by the courts. It depends on the membership. Okay, that's all I'm going to talk about for today. I'll have another lecture for you available on Wednesday. And I'll have a third lecture also available by Wednesday on a particular topic. The first lecture will focus on the last chapter of Dudley Justice. And then the third one will be on the question of who deserves death. And I'll have some particular interactive assignments for you to do. So anyway, thanks for joining me. I'm sorry about the complications with our course. And I wish you the best in getting through all of your assignments. Goodbye.